The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. This is our monthly episode 4, where we get to ask our speaker all the questions that we've gotten from our episodes for the month so far. And by the way, thanks for all your questions and feedback. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. Catherine Hayes is so nice that she came back again. Not only did she come back again for the past few weeks, she came back again for your questions this week, and we really appreciate that. Welcome back, Catherine.
Thanks for having me.
Have you developed any disclosures in the last week?
No, I haven't found anyone who wants to give me more money.
We got to run a classified. Should we do that?
Sounds great.
Just the heading would be something for Dr. Hayes to disclose.
There we go.
Well, we have a couple of questions to deal with. And so let's just dive right in. We talked about PCOS last time, about polycystic. Am I better to say polycystic ovary syndrome or polycystic ovarian syndrome? I see both.
I don't think there's not necessarily a right or wrong answer to that question. If you ask gynecologists, we'd like to rename it altogether. So take your pick.
Are there still gynecologists who say gynecologists?
That tends to be more a European thing.
Is it? Okay. The ovarian thing wouldn't split along those lines either.
No.
Okay. Well, we talked about polycystic ovary syndrome, and you alluded to the fact that there are some things that look like PCOS that aren't PCOS, but we didn't really give you a chance to elaborate on that. Would you like to elaborate on that? What are some of those things and how are they different and how should we differentiate them?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to make. So there's actually a reasonably long list of things to think about when we have PCOS in our differential diagnosis. And really, we kind of consider PCOS a diagnosis of exclusion. You know, we've tried all the other things and they don't fit. Importantly is congenital adrenal hyperplasia. And so you can screen for that with a 17-hydroxyprogesterone level, because it mimics a lot of the same side effects because it has elevated testosterone. And so that's really important to rule out so that we can get those kids treated appropriately with steroids. Mm-hmm. I think kind of also on the top of the list is ruling out androgen secreting tumors. So especially if your testosterone is exceptionally elevated, getting an ultrasound to make sure that there's no tumor in the ovary. And if you're still concerned, considering adrenal imaging as well, as you can have androgen secreting adrenal tumors. And then kind of, lower on the list of things that it might be, but still important to think about, hyperprolactinemia can cause amenorrhea, as well as thyroid dysfunction, because the TSH molecule looks a lot like the FSH molecule and actually readily binds to FSH receptors. And so you can get abnormal bleeding or absence of bleeding with elevated thyroid levels. And then Cushing's, exogenous exposure. Sometimes you'll have kids whose dads are on testosterone therapy and we tend to see this in younger kids who maybe have premature adrenarche, but if they're like touching their dad's skin a lot and actually absorbing their testosterone, that can mess with periods.
From patches or just from the skin?
You tend to see it from the gel, but definitely if the patches are being mishandled, it is a possibility for sure.
Okay.
And then really low on the list, lipodystrophies and severe insulin resistance can cause irregular periods as well. But those top ones that we really think about are making sure she doesn't have a tumor and making sure she doesn't have congenital adrenal hyperplasia.
And are there any things about the history or the physical findings that would make you say, I need to rule this out?
Yeah, so I think that if there's any evidence of clitoromegaly, it's really important. More severe hirsutism or really significant acne, I usually add a 17-hydroxyprogesterone into my labs. I don't get it every patient, but anything that kind of just makes me go, ooh, maybe, it's never wrong to add that.
Okay, so as with so many other things, if it just isn't sitting right, if it gives you a little bit of a stomach ache, then spread the net wider.
Exactly. And 17-hydroxyprogesterone is really just a screening lab. It's best done before 10 a.m., but it can be done any time in the day, although maybe artificially low later in the day. if a patient has a positive or an elevated 17-hydroxyprogesterone, then they need a full ACTH stimulation test to determine if they have congenital adrenal hyperplasia and what their enzyme dysfunction is, because they're not all 21-hydroxylase.
Terrific. Question number two, when should young women plan to start seeing a gynecologist? Are there general guidelines as well as specific circumstances besides obviously needing a consultation about a specific issue that goes beyond the comfort zone of their general provider? And how can we best provide our patients for consultation with a gynecologist?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, ACOG, our national organization, actually says that all teenagers should engage with the system between 13 and 15. And so should establish care with a gynecologist between 13 and 15. I think that's a great theory. It's a little bit difficult in practice because many adult gynecology offices have lower limits that they see patients at, many 16, some 18, some as young as 12, but it can be difficult to find an adult gynecologist to establish with. Many adult gynecologists also are not particularly comfortable with teenage patients because they just don't see a lot of them in their practice. You know, some do, some don't. And there's not enough pediatric gynecologists in the world to go around at this time. And so definitely anyone who's having problems should see us sooner rather than later. But I think that, you know, not unreasonable to kind of push that to 16 to 18 or even 18 to 20. You know, the first pelvic exam that we recommend or the first pap smear for cervical cancer screening is at age 21 currently. And those guidelines are always updated. And so that may change in the future as well. You know, it's never wrong to establish. Just the practicality of it is sometimes difficult.
I think one of the challenges too is that I think for a lot of adult women, they end up seeing their gynecologist as their primary care provider, which doesn't fit as well for a teen patient. And so it is, I think, one of those things where it's important to find the sort of situation where you can still collaborate in a patient's care.
Definitely. Exactly. You know, so many women do consider their OBGYN their primary care provider. And some OBGYNs do provide more primary care, but they're not going to be as comfortable with guidelines for what teens need for primary care and probably is not the appropriate place for them.
There been any discussion of cloning you?
It would be great if we could clone me. We're so excited that hopefully here in the not too distant future, we'll have another pediatric gynecologist at Primary Children's.
Well, you've been wonderful, and we just hope that if that's the case, that that provider can also be wonderful. One of the things we were talking about before we got to the questions is one of the things I think you share with almost anyone who cares for adolescents is the challenge of trying to help adolescents through just the practicalities of taking care of themselves. And particularly, we were talking about the fact that that we all struggle with getting adolescents to do something every day. And in your practice, that's something that's incredibly important, right? Because if you put somebody on a daily medication, they need to take that medication daily. Do you have any tips or tricks for what you do to help walk young women through that?
Yeah, that is so important. And we really talk about the importance of taking the medicine at the same time every day and taking it every day. And so part of our conversation up front is that something you can do? Because if it's not, then maybe we need to consider a different dosing modality. If there's not a contraindication to estrogen, using the estrogen progesterone patch or the estrogen progesterone vaginal ring. Mm-hmm. And if there is a contraindication to estrogen, you know, talking about the other progestin only modalities, although those are a bit more invasive than taking a pill every day. And often kids after that decide they will try to take a pill every day. But we talk about setting an alarm on your phone. And for my, especially my younger teens or my tweens, I also ask their parent to set an alarm on their phone for the exact same time as they're kind of starting to get into the routine. And my favorite thing to tell them is I look them in the eye and I say, if you are someone who likes to ignore your alarm, I want you to set 2, 3, 4, however many alarms you need. And they need to be, you know, every couple of minutes, because it is important to take this medicine at the same time every day. I also talk about practical life things like not picking a time first thing in the morning, because that often means if you're going to take it before school, you might be taking it as early as 6 or 6:30 in the morning. And most teenagers are not particularly inclined to get up at 6 or 6:30 in the morning on Saturday and Sunday or school vacations if they don't have to. And so we talk about, you know, picking times that really work with their life, you know, trying to tie it to something that they do every day for some kids, that's brushing their, you know, brushing. Hopefully every kid is brushing their teeth, but for some kids, tying their pill to their teeth brushing time, because it tends to be fairly consistent. And then troubleshooting, if they are having difficulty, and talking about other options, if they try it and are not doing so great with it.
One of the challenges sometimes too is that, for instance, when somebody's starting on birth control, it can take a couple of cycles before it captures, right? How do you talk people through those expectations when they say it didn't work?
Yeah. So I tell all my patients that we don't call a medicine a failure for at least 3 months. Obviously, if they're having significant side effects that are impacting their life, we're willing to change the medicine sooner, of course. But if they aren't having significant side effects, we really want them to kind of stick through it, because it does take some time. I also, for my kids who don't need contraception, who are using the medicine strictly as, you know, menstrual management methods, I really try to talk about, you know, you can start it now, depending on where they are in their cycle. You know, if, say they're in the middle of their cycle, I say you can start it now, but you're much more likely to have breakthrough bleeding because you're kind of not starting it in sync with your body. Your body is currently building up your endometrial lining, and that is eventually going to need to come out, and that likely will come out as breakthrough bleeding, especially if we're using the method in a continuous fashion, which I often do in my office. And so I will sometimes say, you know, if your periods are reasonably predictable, you may want to just wait until you get this next period. And on the first day of bleeding, go ahead and start the medicine then, because you're much less likely to experience breakthrough bleeding. And for a lot of kids, they're very motivated to try to minimize the discomfort of starting a new medicine.
Sure.
Other kids have really terrible periods and they're like, I don't want to have, I'd rather have a little extra bleeding that might not be as painful rather than waiting. So we just talk about it, and, you know, it's a group think decision, and they ultimately can decide what makes the most sense for them.
And 3 months is a really long time.
It is a really long time when you're a teenager. It goes by fast when you're an adult, but teenagers, wow, it lasts forever.
Yeah. Any other pearls you want to share with us? Anything you've been thinking, boy, I wish I could tell pediatricians that.
It's not yeast. Those prepubertal girls have vaginal itching. It's not yeast. I promise.
You know what? Next time you come on, I'm going to make sure we get a chance to emphasize that again, because
perfect.
People in my office still don't buy it. You know, what is she, a gynecologist or something?
No, what do I know? I don't have any qualifications.
It was on your boards, right?
Over and over.
Exactly. All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us again. Thanks for sharing your expertise. Hope to have you back sometime. Hope that if you have a new partner, we could meet him or her as well. And if people need to reach you for consultation, what's the best way to reach you?
Yeah. So the best way to reach me, you can always call the office, 801-662-1717, and just choose the physician line. Or you can always reach me through the physician access line or the transfer center.
Terrific. Thanks so much. And thanks to all our listeners. Please make sure to remember to like and subscribe. Leave nice reviews. I have a very fragile ego. And please feel free to give us feedback. We get some helpful feedback and requests, and we try to do what we can to make those things happen. We'll talk to you next week. And Catherine, we hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.